From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we look at the strengths and styles of George Bush and John Kerry as debaters with James Fallows, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. We'll talk about Bush and Kerry's performances in past debates and hear some excerpts. And Fallows will discuss what he calls an inventory of opportunities lost by the Bush administration in the year following the September 11th attacks. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz profiles German countertenor Andreas Scholl. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iraqi kidnappers have released two Italian women who've been held hostage for 3 weeks. Italy's prime minister welcomed the news. NPR's Silvia Poggioli reports from Rome.
A beaming Silvio Berlusconi appeared on TV to announce that he'd spoken with the two women, Simona Torretta and Simona Pari, that they are well, and that they were in a taxi on their way to Baghdad airport. The two 29-year-old aid workers had been taken from their office in central Baghdad by armed men on September 7th. The kidnapping of the first two Western women and aid workers who had publicly denounced the war in Iraq and the presence of Western troops in the country had stunned Italy. The two Simonas, as they were dubbed by the media, had been working for an NGO on school and water projects. Two different groups claimed responsibility for the abduction, demanding an Italian troop pull out from Iraq. Today, Berlusconi said the two women had been handed over to the Italian Red Cross following what he called negotiations without offering further details. Silvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
Meanwhile, an Egyptian telephone company said four of its engineers have been set free. It's not clear yet whether two other Egyptians have been released. British hostage Kenneth Bigley, a civil engineer, remains in captivity and under threat of death 12 days after he was taken hostage. Two American colleagues who were abducted with Bigley have been murdered by their captors. A man identified as a French hostage negotiator appeared on Al Arabiya television and said an agreement has been reached for the speedy release of two French journalists who've been held for 5 weeks. French government officials declined to comment. The post-hurricane cleanup continues along Florida's east coast, where many people expect to go for weeks without power. Joe Roberts reports from member station WQCS in Fort Pierce.
The official word from Florida Power and Light is those who live in the areas hardest hit by Hurricane Jeanne may not have power before October 12th. Spokeswoman Rachel Scott says they're working to restore the most essential areas first.
We are continuing to focus on the functions that provide critical public health and safety services. Yesterday, we were able to restore power to Sebastian Police Department and Sebastian City Hall.
Many sections of the barrier island remain off limits to residents due to safety concerns. A man who tried to access the island by boat was intercepted by Coast Guard patrols. He was issued 7 federal citations, had his boat confiscated, and could receive up to $55,000 in fines. For NPR News, I'm Jill Roberts in Fort Pierce, Florida.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 88 points to close at 10,077 in active trading. Gains led advances led declines by 2-1. The Nasdaq gained 10 to 1869. This is NPR News. President Bush and Senator John Kerry stayed out of the public eye today as they prepared for Thursday's debate in Florida. They've been working with aides and advisors on questions that are expected to come up in the session. The rules for the event say that candidates may not move around the stage, may not ask each other questions directly, or challenge each other to make promises. The first of 3 planned sessions will cover foreign policy and homeland security. It'll be held at the University of Miami in Coral Gables, Florida. Oil prices hit a new record of $50.47 a barrel on the New York market today. Traders are waiting for the release of a government report tomorrow on crude oil stockpiles. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The day began with Saudi officials promising to increase oil production, but the pledge seemed to have limited effect. Oil prices briefly rose above $50, then fell back and finished the day just under $50. Prices rose this week after a rebel group in Nigeria ordered foreign petroleum companies to leave the country. The market is also suffering from the impact of Hurricane Ivan and the disruption of production facilities in the Gulf of Mexico. Prices have now risen 56% for the year as a whole. Traders are anxiously awaiting the release of a report on energy stockpiles by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. It's expected to show that crude oil stocks fell for the ninth straight week. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Consumer confidence fell in September for the second month in a row. The Conference Board said its index of consumer confidence dropped nearly 2 points to 96.8. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Toyota. Together with their dealers and suppliers, Toyota employs over 190,000 individuals throughout the U.S. Toyota.com/USA.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Thursday night, George W. Bush and John Kerry will meet in Coral Gables, Florida, for the first of three presidential debates. My guest, journalist James Fallows, recently spent hours watching tapes of both Bush and Kerry in past debates, and he wrote about their strengths and styles in a recent issue of the Atlantic Monthly. Later in the show, we'll discuss his piece in the October issue titled Bush's Lost Year, about the choices the administration made following the September 11th attacks. Fallows is national correspondent for The Atlantic. He was chief speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter, but he spent most of his career writing for and editing a number of publications, including U.S. News and World Report. He's also the author of four books, including National Security and Breaking the News, How the Media Undermined American Democracy. I spoke to James Fallows yesterday. You spent some time recently looking at a number of George W. Bush's past performances in debates, including his 1994 gubernatorial debate in the Texas gubernatorial campaign with then-Governor Ann Richards. Set this up for us. Give us the context of that face-off.
What was interesting about the 94 gubernatorial race is how Bush, in the debate and the race itself, defied expectations. He came into that race against Ann Richards, a decided underdog, at least for the debate. Richards was at that time highly celebrated in Texas and the Democratic Party, even nationally, for her oratorical skills. She'd given a mocking speech about the elder George Bush, the Democratic convention. She had had a past behind her as a debate champion in college. She'd won a debate scholarship to Baylor University. And while Bush had some advantages on his side in the race, you know, writ large, including Karl Rove as his main consultant, and Texas is beginning the shift from a basically Democratic to a basically Republican state, the debate seemed to be Richards's to win. And, you know, that everything about the Bush campaign going into the debate reinforced that impression. They tried to stall in having debate. They finally agreed reluctantly only to one. Their pre-debate spin to all the Texas press was, you know, geez, how can you expect us to hold up against this woman who's the champion debater of all Texas? You know, we're not for all this fancy talk. And when the debate occurred, Bush having sort of talked himself into this heavy underdog role, the surprise was that he didn't simply, you know, beat the point spread and beat expectations, but he actually was better than Ann Richards, you know, during those 60 minutes of debate at getting his main points across.
Well, let's listen to a clip from this. This is the 1994 gubernatorial debate, George W. Bush versus then-Governor Ann Richards. And in this case, we're going to hear George W. Bush answer a pretty tough question from Paul Burka of Texas Monthly. He's talking about Bush's claim that he is an outsider running against politicians. Let's hear this clip from the 1994 debate.
I understand every politician wants to present themselves as an outsider. You were the son of a president of the United States. You were an advisor to him. That hardly seems like you're an outsider. You say you proudly say you've never held public office. But you sought public office and you got beat. You ran for Congress. Maybe you're proud of it. I don't know. But isn't it a little disingenuous to say that to portray yourself as an outsider?
Well, I've never held office, Paul. I mean, I'm only telling you the way the facts are. I'm not proud of the fact that I got whipped in 78. I did come in second in a two-man race. Here's my point. My point is that if you want someone to think the way it's been all along in Austin, they should not be for me. I am not happy with the welfare system. I think we need to reform the welfare system to end dependency upon government. I am not happy with the fact that nothing has happened in the juvenile justice code in our state. We have children who do not fear the consequences of the law in the state of Texas because nothing has been done to change a code which is outdated, outmoded, and totally ineffective. I want to decontrol the school system of the state of Texas. I believe that the only way to achieve excellence in the classrooms of the schools of Texas is to free teachers and parents and principals from the constraints and rules of the Texas Education Agency. I am not a fine tuner, and therefore the fact that I haven't held political office, in my opinion, gives me the freedom to think differently than someone who has spent her entire career in public office.
That was George W. Bush in his 1994 debate against then-Texas Governor Ann Richards. Bush won that election, and in the eyes of our guest, James Fallows won the debate. James Fallows, what do you hear in that exchange from George W. Bush?
I hear some things that are different from the President Bush we know today, and some other probably more important things are the same. It's fascinating, and I think even more listening to it just now than it was when I was watching this in videotape, to listen to the quality of candidate Bush's language. You know, all the sentences you will notice were fairly complex and well-formed. His diction was pretty rapid. There were a number of sort of complicated words which you expect him, if you hear him talking now, to kind of pause before those words, and he rolled right through them. And so at a sort of surface fluency level, it's different from the man we hear today. At a strategic level, I think what we heard from George Bush 10 years ago is exactly what we're likely to hear from him in these debates. And what we've heard in his sort of best moments in the stump over the last month or so, as he's been out among sympathetic crowds. And what that is a combination of seeming to address the question that's asked him. He did answer Paul Burka's question with a joke of sort of, you know, limited humor about being second in a two-man race. But he was gracious about saying, yes, you know, I tried before and I lost. But then you notice him saying, here's my point. This is what we call, you know, skillful on-messagism. When Bush is at his best, he has two or three main points that again and again and again, with no embarrassment about repetition, but with great, you know, clarity and certainty, he says, here is what I have, you know, to tell you. In Texas, it was all the things you saw, the welfare system, personal accountability, juvenile justice. In the presidential campaign this year, of course, it's going to be, I have made you safer. We have the terrorists on the run. The war in Iraq is seamlessly connected to the attacks on 9/11 and the larger war on terrorism. So if the president is performing in this coming week as well as he did 10 years ago, he might not be able to match that sort of word-for-word and sentence-for-sentence dexterity and fluidity, but his strategy, I suspect, will be identical to what we just heard.
You know, I also watched that 1994 debate between then-candidate Bush and Governor Ann Richards. And I was also struck by just how sure-footed this president seems. Why do you think we see this contrast between that candidate who seemed so well-spoken and the speaker today who has such difficulty?
I've come closer to having an explanation for that in the month or so after this piece came out than I did beforehand. I asked a number of people this, and there were all sorts of hypotheses and explanations. One hypothesis, which George Lakoff, the linguist from UC Berkeley, has been most sort of vigorous in pushing, is the idea that the president speaks the way he does now on purpose. That's a way of accentuating a sort of NASCAR tough guy, unyielding, not being distracted with fancy lingo kind of personality. And I can see some of that. Clearly, the president has been more broadly educated than he makes clear in a lot of his diction. But it's hard for me to believe that the most embarrassing parts of some of his current seeming aphasias are really intentional. For example, he didn't falter when answering Paul Burka's question about why he lost the election, but this spring at a press conference when asked if he'd ever made a mistake, he just stood there. So there's a hypothesis that it's on purpose. What is most convincing to me, and what people in Texas told me they believed, was that he was so entirely comfortable in the environment in Texas, with the people, with the issues, with the dreaded nuances, with everything else about that environment, that he could have the sort of affable, charming side of himself come out in public appearances too. And the strongest confirmation for that would be that in the last month or so, when he's been on the road with friendly crowds, people who are bucking him up, he has sounded somewhat more like the Bush of old. You know, not quite as quick in his diction as he used to be, but more like that person. So I think it's a familiarity issue. That's the best I can do.
One of the things you see in that 1994 gubernatorial debate is he has about 4 points that he comes back to again and again and again. And when he states them, they're all extremely well-crafted statements. Is it a matter of preparation?
Yes. The Bush associates, especially from Texas, whom I interviewed, stressed that what's true for everybody seems to be even more true for George Bush, which is that practice makes perfect, or practice at least makes better, and that they explained his faltering performance in some of his spontaneous remarks this year, you know, some of his press conferences, some of his TV appearances, as reflecting the fact that he hadn't really worked on this kind of presentation. Whereas before his debate with Ann Richards, before his debate with Al Gore 4 years ago, he really did work. He went to debate camp. He practiced again and again and again. And it seems to be in preparing for I would assume that in preparing for this year's debate, John Kerry should assume that Bush is working very hard.
One of the low moments in George W. Bush's oratorical history has to have been his appearance earlier this year with Tim Russert on Meet the Press. Remind us how that went.
This was when, in contrast to his successful appearances or successful performances where George Bush has 3 or 4 points he wants to get to, but he sort of shows the connection between what the person was asking and the point he wants to make. I Meet the Press with Tim Russert, he was not able to show the connections. He almost visibly had his index cards, you know, in front of him and said, you know, point one, we are safer because of the war in Iraq. And so when Tim Russert would ask him, well, what about no weapons of mass destruction? What about things going badly in Iraq? All the president could do was sort of just repeat himself and almost stammer. And that's the difference, as I understand it, between a George Bush who is prepared and knows how to make the connection between the question he's asked and the point he wants to make, and the Bush who is not prepared and just seems to be, you know, robot-like reading off his note card. When he's not prepared, when he's not ready to handle questions, he can, you know, he can be at his worst. There's two ways in which the president can be at his worst when caught by surprise. One is looking sort of dumbfounded and had what I call the unfortunate puzzled chimp expression. The other and less frequent but more damaging way is when he loses his temper. You know, he is said to have quite a sharp temper, like his mother, and he's revealed it a couple of times. One was with the Irish or BBC interview a few months ago, where he was sort of putting the interviewer back in her place. The other was against John McCain, where he got sort of first defensive and then angry against John McCain in 2000. Bush's impatience and sort of nasty haughtiness can come out when he gets mad.
Have Bush's opponents underestimated him?
Yes. Partly they've been extrapolating from the way he answers questions at press conferences and thinking, well, gee, this will be a snap in a debate. Partly they have fallen for a very skillful and consistent strategy by the Bush team, which has been to lowball the debates going in. They know that debates like presidential primaries are often scored by the press on an expectations basis. Well, you know, he came in second in New Hampshire, but he beat expectations. They also know that more people are going to hear about the debates, and especially hear what the talking heads start saying immediately afterwards in the next couple of days, than actually see them. And so to the extent they can condition that reaction to be, well, Bush did much better than expected, that's paid off. I think that's harder to do this time than before, both because Bush's success, past success, is more evident now, it's because the Kerry campaign is not letting them do it. There was an amusing time, I guess, in September when the chairman of the Republican Party said that John Kerry was, you know, the most accomplished debater since Cicero. And that seemed to be overreaching the strategy. Also, we're an incumbent president. It's harder for him to say, well, you know, aw shucks, I don't really know that much of the fancy details. You can't expect me to do well in a debate.
My guest is writer James Fallows. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Fallows. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He recently watched tapes of past debates by both George W. Bush and John Kerry and wrote about them in the magazine. Let's talk about John Kerry. The knock on him as a public speaker is that he comes off as stiff, sometimes pompous. How has he been on his feet in debates?
Well, you know, just as Bush is a better debater than you'd think listening to him answer questions, Kerry is a better debater than you'd think listening to him give speeches. The meta theory here is there's two very, very different realms of oratorical achievement and discourse, and Kerry surprisingly has succeeded in both of them despite their differences. One of them is sort of the formal oratory mode, and Kerry has worked at that since before the time he was in high school. He's winning speaking and debating prizes at St. Paul's in prep school and at Yale, and afterwards at Yale, one of his achievements was to knock off a previously unbeaten debate team that was visiting from Oxford or Cambridge, and he was celebrated for those skills. And you hear those in play in his formal speeches now, which above all else are formal, and they sound senatorial and they can sound somewhat starchy. There's the very different realm of political debate performance, and although the skills required there are separate, he's very good at those too, and I would argue he's better at those.
Now, in 1996, John Kerry fought a very tough re-election battle for his U.S. Senate seat with Governor William Weld, a campaign that is remembered for no fewer than 8 face-to-face debates, 2 really smart, experienced public officials going at it. What did you learn about John Kerry's performance in that series of debates?
The sort of first big surprise of listening to that many hours of two smart men talk is that actually it was quite interesting. You know, I have a limited stomach for sort of formal political oratory, including that by Senator Kerry. But I was in some strange way sorry when these 12 hours of footage were over. Partly because it was at a high level. These are two very smart, accomplished men, very proud men, very confident men, and they were different in their styles, but they both were good. The interesting thing is that Kerry was better to listen to this way in debate than he is in formal speeches. And the reason is he seems to shift into a different personality. He's much more like a prosecutor than he is like a senator when he's in these debates, where you can see him thinking fast and sort of trying to edge around the witness, trying to kind of turn the argument around, trying to say, well, surely you're not suggesting, et cetera. And so it's usually engrossing to watch on TV or in movies or read in books courtroom dramas and seeing how very skillful, on-their-feet advocates are doing their job. And that's what Kerry is like at his best as a debater. You can see him making these quite fast and graceful moves.
Well, let's hear a clip from one of these debates between John Kerry and Governor William Weld. And this is a widely noted exchange that involves Governor William Weld attacking John Kerry's stance on the death penalty and invoking a particularly troubling case. Let's listen to the clip.
Could you look into the camera, perhaps at Ann Scavina, who's here, whose son was a Springfield police officer cut down by a murderer, tell her why the life of the man that murdered her son is worth more than the life of her son, the police officer?
Well, Governor, I would say to you, I would say to her, and I would say to every citizen in this country, it's not worth more. It's not. It's not worth anything. It's scum that ought to be thrown into jail for the rest of its life and that ought to learn day after day the pain and hell of living with a loss of freedom and with the crime committed. But the fact is, Governor, that yes, I've been opposed to the death penalty. I know something about killing. I don't like killing. And I don't think a state honors life by turning around and sanctioning killing. Now, that's just a personal belief that I have.
That was John Kerry answering Governor William Weld in the 1996 Massachusetts Senate race, one of the more famous debates that John Kerry was involved in. James Fallows, what do you hear in the clip we just heard?
It's very interesting to contrast that with the famous and notorious answer that Michael Dukakis gave when running against the elder George Bush in 1988, when he was asked what he would do if his wife were raped and murdered. And he gave this very factual-sounding, clinical answer. Kerry, by contrast, first addressed the question with sort of emotional reaction to the intrinsic horror of it, of how much he would hate the criminals, and then with this I Know Something About Killing line, which everyone tells me in his camp was not scripted, not prepared, but thought up on the scene, he was able to introduce quite subtly and effectively the whole Vietnam issue without being ham-handed about it and give a kind of emotional backing for his anti-death penalty stand.
You've made the point that George W. Bush does best when he is extensively prepared. Kerry may have a problem sometimes with having too much time to go into the nuances of every issue. Does he seem to do better when he has too little time to express his ideas?
I say yes and no. The no part is something I've sort of come to think about since writing that article. The yes part is that almost everybody who knows John Kerry suggests that he is somebody whose highest powers are brought out when he feels under pressure. You know, in athletic endeavors, in combat, as we've all heard, when his campaign is behind, et cetera. This seems to be where he is most engaged and fired up. The part where I think preparation may be important for him is in two very specific aspects of these debates. First, they have relatively short time limits on the answers, which I think actually works to John Kerry's advantage because he will be forced in his debate training to boil his answers down to a shorter version than their natural length, and that will help him. The second thing that I think preparation will help is he has to come up with a formulation on Iraq which is as crisp as the one the president has. The president says, we went to Iraq and we are safer. Senator Kerry needs to find a way to say right back, you know, we went to Iraq and we're worse off, or whatever he would say. But that is something he needs to work up.
Can John Kerry make himself likable in this debate?
Not to the degree that Ronald Reagan might, or Gerald Ford in his affable way. And I think the lesson of personality in national politics is you can't make yourself somebody you aren't. You know, when Richard Nixon would give his sort of nervous smile or try to tell a joke, it just was even creepier than the real Nixon. So it's a matter of presenting a version of yourself that seems authentic to people. But I think that John Kerry doesn't really need to make himself, you know, Mr. Smiley or Mr. Let's go have a beer to succeed in the debate or the election. What he has to, you know, the strength he has is to be the serious, competent guy, the grown-up, if you will, who can say, look, listen to me, we're making a big mistake here in name your policy area. The course we're on is wrong. I'm going to take us on the right course and listen to me do that. So I think Ryan, rather than trying to prime him with jokes, trying to present himself as the most effective, serious, earnest, responsible guy is probably the way to go.
The Atlantic Monthly national correspondent, James Fallows. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the Sundance Channel, presenting The Al Franken Show, political commentary, comedy, and interviews, premieres weeknights at 11:30 on Sundance Channel. From the German Information Center, celebrating the Day of German Unity, October 3rd. GIC on the web at germany.unity.org. And by Harcourt, publishers of Gifts, the new fantasy by Ursula K. Le Guin, author of the Earthsea novels. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what the Bush administration did and did not do in the year following the September 11th attacks. We continue our conversation with James Fallows. His piece titled Bush's Lost Year appears in the current Atlantic Monthly magazine. Also, Lloyd Schwartz profiles German countertenor Andreas Scholl. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest, James Fallows, is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His piece in the magazine's current edition, titled Bush's Lost Year, explores decisions the administration made in early 2002, when the nation had deposed the Taliban regime in Afghanistan and was considering its next steps in the war on terror. Fallows said he spoke to people at the working level of America's anti-terrorist efforts, in military, diplomatic, and intelligence positions, as well as some in Washington think tanks. Well, James Fallows, you say that George W. Bush and the United States began the year 2002, which, of course, was 3 months after the September 11th attacks. They began that year shocked and wounded, but with tremendous strategic advantages. It was a time of opportunity. What do you mean?
What I mean is, and the point of this whole article, is that everyone recognizes that the events of September 11th, 2001 were, in one day, a series of world-changing events. But I try to argue that the decisions that were made in 2002 were, in a way, more consequential, and that there were certain paths we went down that year which will have effects for a very long time. So I'm trying to contrast the difference between the choices that were available to the United States in January of that year and the ones that were available at the end. For example, the beginning of the year, the United States still had, you know, had a population almost totally unified behind its president. It had almost unvarying international support. It still had a practically balanced federal budget. It had a military that was rested, prepared, ready. It had an opportunity, if it chose, to reexamine a lot of the fundamental issues that have been problems for a long time: our relationship with Saudi Arabia, our relationship with Egypt, our standing in the Israel-Palestine dispute, our dependence on oil in general. If there were a time to address fundamental, and it also had Osama bin Laden on the run on the borderland between Afghanistan and Pakistan. So one possibility that would have been open to us would have been to concentrate on getting Osama bin Laden, to concentrate on pacifying Afghanistan, to reorder our relationships with Saudi Arabia, to do the same in Middle East politics, and basically to say, what are the things which we've not been able to do in the past, but now we can do to address our real long-term security interests?
Well, how did the Bush administration evaluate its options and make its priorities?
What I chronicle in this article is the way, month by month, all the possible options in a war on terrorism and a struggle for improved national security became reduced to the single dimension of war in Iraq. And you found in Afghanistan there was effort and troops and money deflected so as to be ready for Iraq. You found that with Iran and North Korea, which are clearly much closer to nuclear weapons than the worst suspicions of Iraq ever were, that we've lost time in dealing with them. Clearly, there's been a division of the domestic population, fractures with our allies. The army is now overused. The budget is now expended. We spend, you know, far more every week in Iraq now than we do on all homeland security operations put together. So the chronicle of going from this range of options to one option, which is Iraq, which crowds out the rest, that's the chronicle of that year.
You make the point that President Bill Clinton had a directive for handling international crises, which the Bush administration revoked. Now, this is maybe a little bit of sort of internal government mechanics, but did that limit the Bush's ability to consider the options it had and the consequences of its decisions?
Yes, and there are all sorts of these inside baseball details that turn out to be quite important. Clinton administration in the mid-90s had put together this sort of extensive presidential decision memorandum. I forget exactly its number. It might be 56 or something like that. And the idea was, for the foreseeable future, the United States was going to be confronting a different kind of war. It wouldn't be like World War II. It wouldn't be like Vietnam. It would be a war in which all elements of national power would be combined. We'd need the normal military. We'd need the special forces. We'd need humanitarian efforts. We need diplomatic efforts. We need the CIA. And so the crucial thing was to enable all parts of the government to play together and coordinate these activities. For reasons either of policy or just of bureaucracy, when the Bush administration came in, it revoked that order. And it didn't come up with anything new to replace it by the time of September 11th. And certainly, you know, it hasn't done so since. And so the efforts, one of the main hallmarks in retrospect of the efforts after September 11th, and especially the preparations for Iraq, is how little coherent coordination there was among the parts of government that should have been working together. For example, the State Department had an elaborate project on what would be necessary in post-war Iraq, and the Defense Department, which was put in charge of post-war Iraq, never even looked at it. There were constant battles over who would in fact be in charge and how the so-called stovepiping problem, that is, information being separated and never sort of crossing the institutional boundaries, could be solved. These were all things which had been addressed, 6 years earlier by the Clinton administration, and were sort of reinvented. And if there is another such enterprise in a further administration, maybe there'll be some new plan, but much of the wheel spinning of the last 3 years can be traced back to that decision.
Let's look at a couple of specifics. Others have made the point that while the administration has focused on removing Saddam Hussein, rebuilding Iraq, the whole war effort, that it has paid too little attention to the nuclear program of North Korea. Now, that is on the other side of the world. Why can't an administration pursue a war in the Middle East and still also undertake the diplomatic efforts that it and technical efforts it needs to deal with the crisis in North Korea? Shouldn't a government this size be able to handle both things at once?
It should, in theory. And I think there's a high policy reason and then a human reason. The high policy reason is that one of the decisions the Bush administration made about going into Iraq was that it cared more about achieving this goal than it did about, maintaining its allied relationships in general. As obviously became clear, many of our strongest and most traditional allies, with the exception of Great Britain, were very much opposed to the strategy the U.S. took. And so the administration made the strategic choice. We will step aside from them on this issue so as to pursue our objective. So as a high policy matter, if you need allied cooperation, as everyone says you do, to deal with both the Iran and the North Korea problems, it's that much harder if they're bitterly at odds with you on the main thing you're doing. The human reason is one that was stressed to me by Richard Clark, the renowned former terrorism chief for both the Reagan, Clinton, and Bush White Houses. He was saying, you would think that people in a government this vast could walk and chew gum at the same time. But in reality, a very small number of people are making these decisions. As he put it, there's one Secretary of State and there's one Secretary of Defense and they each have one deputy and there's one National Security Advisor. And if they are spending their time just engrossed in a crisis, as they clearly were, about Iraq, there simply is not give in the system or in their minds or in the center of gravity of effort to deal with other things. You see this in small organizations, but it's true in a vast federal government as well. And so he said it just is in the nature of governmental life. If there's one crisis that so dominates everything else, these other things just get ignored.
Afghanistan is the other area in which there was a clear choice to be made. The United States put, if I recall, about 10,000 troops into Afghanistan. What did the United States not do in Afghanistan by focusing on Iraq?
There were a number of decisions in Afghanistan, all of which had the effect of conserving American troop strength. One reason for trying to conserve American troop strength was Donald Rumsfeld's desire to demonstrate that a light force using unconventional weapons and working with alliances could get the job done. But also there was clearly and increasingly a desire to hold forces in reserve for Iraq. One important thing that the U.S. did was to rely on other people to do crucial parts of the job. We relied, of course, on the Northern Alliance, the tribes of the Northern Alliance, to hunt down Osama bin Laden. And we relied on the Pakistanis also to seal the border with Afghanistan, where Osama and his colleagues were. Neither of those allies was as interested in getting that job done as the U.S. was, and the job wasn't really done. Osama is obviously at large as we speak. So one missed opportunity was having U.S. soldiers do that job of catching Osama bin Laden.
Let's be concrete here. How large of a force would it have taken to get into Afghanistan? And what about the lesson of the Soviet experience that big armies get chewed up in those mountains by villagers who don't want to see foreigners there?
Sure. Nobody I've spoken with has recommended a U.S. sort of forced conquest of Afghanistan on the Soviet model. The question here is crucial deference of U.S. to non-U.S. control as the noose appeared to be getting closed around Osama bin Laden, the Battle of Tora Bora, and then in Operation Anaconda, where no one knows exactly how many soldiers it might have taken, but a if the U.S. were willing to place the same emphasis, and as one former ambassador told me, was as willing to break crockery to catch Osama bin Laden as it had been to dethrone Saddam Hussein, that presumably this would have been a more feasible challenge to say, to put the pressure on both Pakistan and whatever forces in Afghanistan to say it matters more to us than anything else to capture this al-Qaeda leadership. So it's not, you can't say for certain that it would be doable, but it would not be like the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in toto.
My guest is writer James Fallows. We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with James Fallows. He is a national correspondent for The Atlantic and has written about the forthcoming presidential debates. In the current issue, he has a piece called Bush's Lost Year. It's about what he regards as some opportunities lost in 2002 by the Bush administration. The Bush administration is believed by many to have essentially disengaged from the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. How does that fit into the options and opportunities that Bush faced in 2002?
Well, in 2001, before the attacks, President Bush quite proudly said that this was, you know, we were not going to meddle in this conflict. It was going nowhere. We'll let the parties on the ground work it out themselves. After the attacks of September 11th, clearly the ferment in the Arab Islamic world in general became a part of the problem that the United States had to deal with, and so re-engagement was inevitable for the U.S. And there were sort of two contending theories about how the war in Iraq and the struggle in the Middle East were related, the Israel-Palestinian struggle. One was the theory the administration apparently applied, which was you could sum up, they often summed up as the road to Jerusalem leads through Baghdad. That is, once they removed Saddam Hussein, once they got rid of an obvious threat to Israel, once they showed their toughness, then they'd be in a better position to try to put pressure both on the Sharon government in Israel and on the Palestinians to say, okay, you have to make a deal. We have to enforce a land for peace deal. The opposing view, which most foreign governments subscribe to and which Tony Blair reportedly pitched hard to George Bush, was the road to Baghdad leads through Jerusalem. That is, the United States had to show that it was more serious about putting pressure on the Sharon government in particular in order to get some kind of consensus and consent in the Arab Islamic world to its good faith in getting rid of Saddam Hussein. So clearly the strategy the U.S. chose was that by taking over Iraq, they'd have a better time in the Middle East. To date, it hasn't worked out that way, but we'll see.
I guess the defenders of the Bush administration's approach here would say that what the war in Iraq has done is to demonstrate American will and resolve and to make a very clear point to any future host state for terrorists or potential nuclear power that we will act and act decisively so that governments in Syria and Iran learn the lesson that Saddam Hussein learned the hard way. What about that argument?
Well, certainly there is that argument, and the strongest case people give is in Libya. Colonel Gaddafi has been more forthcoming in the last 2 years than he'd been for the previous 15 years. So there is that possible positive demonstration effect. There seem to be a number of negative demonstration effects, too. One is the derived lesson for any state that has the potential of getting nuclear weapons is that it better hurry up and get them. Because the main reason the United States could invade Iraq and couldn't invade North Korea is that North Korea almost certainly already has nuclear weapons. And the United States could not take the risk of the destruction to Seoul in particular and South Korea in general of invading North Korea. So it is a commonplace in the diplomatic world now that the race to develop nuclear weapons is faster among many potential possessor states now, because if they get them, they are safer against the U.S. than they would be otherwise. The other demonstration effect is on sort of the recruiting of future terrorists. The Bush administration points out that it's knocked off two-thirds of the people on its wanted list from al-Qaeda. Almost every other source points out that there are thousands of new recruits to al-Qaeda. The International Institute of Strategic Studies in London said a month or two ago there are about something like 18,000 active al-Qaeda operatives now, roughly three times as many as before the Iraq War, largely because of the demonstration effect of the Iraq War.
A lot of these criticisms we hear from Democratic partisan sources, particularly in an election year, to what extent do these represent the views of independent thinkers in think tanks or among retired military or intelligence personnel?
I'll tell you what my experience has been. Almost the entirety of people I've been interviewing for the last year and a half has been people at the working level of the military and intelligence establishments. A number of people in active military service, a number of recent retirees, you know, who are still relatively young since you leave the military young. A number of people both active and retired in the CIA, other intelligence agencies, the State Department. And there is virtual unanimity among these people that this war has turned out quite badly from the strategic point of view of the United States. I say virtual unanimity because some people say, well, you know, we had to do it and we still have to. Almost everyone recognizes that before the war, most intelligence estimates said that Iraq probably did have some kind of weapons of mass destruction. But the way the war has been carried out, both in the absence of alliances and the chaos since the fall of Baghdad a year and a half ago, has made people think that it's been a strategic catastrophe for the U.S. in the way our troops are tied down in a very difficult situation, the opportunity cost in Iran and North Korea, the undermining of our relationship with our allies, the financial cost, and all of the new hostility that's been built up in the Arab world as we have essentially confirmed the warnings that Osama bin Laden had been laying out in his preachings about what the U.S. would do if it had the chance.
After September 11th, Bush made a policy speech in which he essentially said, terrorists hate us because they hate freedom and democracy. You call this notion in your piece dangerous claptrap. Why?
The formulation the president most often uses is they hate us for who we are, they hate us because we are free. And this, the two halves of it, dangerous and claptrap, I'll explain what I mean. The dangerous part is that if you believe this, that it is something in the essence of our finest aspects that creates hostility in the Arabic world, the only take-home message you have is, well, there's nothing we could possibly change or be doing wrong in any way. It's only because of our outstandingness, our achievements, our sort of rise up the evolutionary ladder of societies that we are resented, and so we just have to find some way to squash and quash this destructive envy that's coming from the outside world. The claptrap part is because this seems to reflect so little nuanced understanding of how Islamic terrorism has actually accelerated over the last 10 or 15 years. And it's, you know, one of the main maxims of war is to know your enemy, understand your enemy. During the Cold War, we spent a lot of effort trying to understand communism and the Soviet bloc and what their vulnerabilities were. There are lots of people in the government who have done just that with Islamic terrorists and some other terrorists too. And they point out that while, of course, there is this envy of the Islamic world, of the Western world, and while, of course, there is cultural disapproval of some of the libertine ways of the West from some of the more restricted Islamic societies, the real root of this is specific policy disagreements. It has to do with America's policy on the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. It has to do with our tolerance of repressive regimes that happen to provide us with oil. It has to do, crucially, with having troops in Saudi Arabia, which has been a huge issue. It has to do with the occupation of Iraq, which contains many very holy Islamic sites. It has to do with the number of Iraqis being killed, civilians, as part of the ongoing war. So it's just to say, well, you know, there's nothing we can do about it, these people are just insane, doesn't take you any distance towards understanding why they're doing these things and how they can be offset, controlled, and undermined.
Well, James Fallows, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Atlantic Monthly's national correspondent, James Fallows. Coming up, Lloyd Schwartz on Andreas Scholl, who sings in a register higher than tenor. This is Fresh Air. The movement to restore historically authentic performances of music from the 18th century and earlier has led to a revival of interest in the highest range of the male voice. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz thinks the most remarkable of the current crop of men who sing in a register higher than tenor is the German countertenor Andreas Scholl.
I first heard Andreas Scholl on a trip to Dresden 4 years ago. "You have to hear him," a German friend told me. "You won't believe it." My friend was right. Not only did the beauty of Scholl's voice impress me, but also his natural, unshowy expressiveness. Countertenors usually have small falsetto voices, but Scholl's voice had an amplitude I'd never heard before. He's more than 6 feet tall. Maybe that's what gives his voice such resonance. The church where I heard him seemed to reverberate with his sound. Since then, I've heard him a couple of times in the U.S., and my first impression was confirmed. His voice pours into a large hall as easily as a hand filling a glove. It's the one quality you can't tell from a recording, where engineers can make even the tiniest squeak sound huge. But recordings certainly capture Scholl's other qualities. Here he is singing a haunting German Baroque song, Johann Philipp Krieger's An die Einsamkeit, to solitude. In Germany, Scholl is a star, and he's made numerous recordings for the Harmonia Mundi label, including solo recital albums such as one of English lute songs, which he sings with impeccable diction. Would that more American singers could project the English language so eloquently. He has a sense of humor, too, as he demonstrates in a German song called The Art of Kissing. On an album called The Countertenors, a witty, even wicked parody of the three tenors, he satirizes the feminine aspect of the countertenor voice. But Scholl's greatest gift is in singing the greatest music, like the alto solos in the two great Bach Passions. Here's his moving performance of one of the most profound arias ever written, from the St. Matthew Passion, Erbarmadich, have mercy on me. The conductor is Philippe Herreweg. Scholl's latest album, For Decca, includes first recordings of 17th and early 18th century Italian cantatas dealing with the imaginary earthly paradise, Arcadia. He's also in two of Handel's greatest oratorios, singing the title role in Solomon and David, the real hero of Handel's Saul. The last time I heard Scholl in person, at Harvard, crowds flocked around the table where his CDs were being sold. That's when I decided to write this review. I want more people in this country to know about an artist this good.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a financial services company serving nearly 3 million members. Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, where values thrive. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how a Texas exterminator rose to become one of the most powerful men in Congress. Journalist Lou Dubo says House Majority Leader Tom DeLay raised tens of millions of dollars to reward friends and punish enemies, altering the shape of American democracy. His book is called The Hammer. Join us for the next Fresh Air.